The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.
Alison Hines, just, you know, make my guest feel a little more comfortable as she hears from a fellow countrywoman as we step into our book club feature for today. Welcome, welcome, and good morning to you, Miss Gould. How are you doing? And welcome to Freedom 106.5 FM. So tell me a little bit about yourself, Fatima. How are you?
Good morning, good morning. I am hot. It is hot here.
In Barbados right now?
I'm Barbadian, but live in Toronto.
Oh.
But it is hot. It's same kind of hot. I will see you wearing a sweater. I'm like, what is going on?
It's freezing in this studio.
I would give for some of that freezing because it's like 31 going up to 33 today. So.
Oh, okay.
But I'm good.
So that's a Toronto summer that you're feeling.
Woo, and an internal one, external one, all the other ones that you can think of. I'm having them all.
So tell me a little bit about yourself. How did you get into writing? You know, what was your foundation like?
What I really wanted to do, because I was a single mom for many years, mm-hmm. and initially what I wanted to do was to write like a manual for single parents to navigate making your, you got to do home, work, activities, all those other things that you were responsible inside, outside the house, everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to make like a little manual that you put in your back pocket and you just pull it out and you say, okay, today I'm going to do this, structure it. Mm-hmm. Then I'm going to slot in some time for self-care, me time, all this stuff. And then when I met the ghostwriter said, your story is more impactful. Your story is more powerful. You should write that.
Mm-hmm.
And then every time I talked about it, I would hit my hand and I would say, how do people get over the walls of life? And then the ghostwriter said, oh, that's what you should call the book, Over the Wall. Mm-hmm. And that's how I got into it. I just wanted to be a self-help for parents, but now it's transcended into this amazing thing.
And this would be your first, second book?
This is my first book.
Mm-hmm.
And then the one I'm working on now is called Messages of Hope. And I just sat down last night and I printed out the framework for it. During COVID, I would do a series on Facebook and mm-hmm. then I made it into a YouTube channel where I break down words and give them a motivational meeting. So I'm going to have that ready by the end of the year. It's 146 words that I have to break down. And then I have to formulate it and put pictures, all this good stuff.
So basically, this book is a how-to-do life.
This book now turned into my life story. So my life story is, in less than 2 minutes, mm-hmm. is me being born in Toronto, being sent to Barbados to be raised by my grandmother for 8 years,
mm.
coming back to Toronto, and then having to face microaggressions, anti-Black racism, cultural identity, and navigate getting to know my mom. Because right. I only remember her seeing her once in those 8 years. So how does that 8-year-old navigate all of that inside that trauma inside of her world?
Mm-hmm.
And then meeting my kid's dad, who same thing happened to him, but he was born in St. Vincent, then migrated to Canada. So when we got together, we didn't know what it was like to be raised by mother and father because we were both raised by grandparents. So can you agree that being raised by grandparents is very different than being raised by your parents?
Very much right? So, especially from a Caribbean perspective.
Yeah. 100%.
Yeah.
100%. So we didn't make it, but we have two kids. Our son is 26 and our daughter's 24 today. And then the last half of the book talks about meeting my husband, who I met when I was 12. We were friends for 6 years, apart for 25, and now we've been married for 13 years.
Wow, and that has been a really big journey. I remember reading a book for literature in school called Harriet, and the story was similar. I can't recall which country her story originated from, but same type of migration story where her parents lived in Toronto, was sent back to the Caribbean to spend some time with the grandparents. And she learned a lot about, discipline was different. you know, and the way in which Caribbean life was a little freer, but at the same time, a little restrictive in the way in which the elders saw discipline, you know. So that story came out of it. From your experience of the transition from moving from the Caribbean experience to Toronto, what was that like? People will call it a culture shock, but can you describe that transition?
It was a culture shock. It was trauma. It was a whole lot of things when you reflect back at it as an adult. As a kid, you're just resilient and you're just taught to just suck it up, forget about it, pick yourself up and go. Mm-hmm. But then when I looked at it and I talked to somebody I went to school with that was a psychologist, she said, "You had trauma in your life twice." I'm like, "Twice? What are you talking about?" And I didn't even know it was trauma. Mm-hmm. See how we live? That's how resilient we are. It's trauma, but we don't even call it trauma. We just call it life. Mm-hmm. Life is life. So she said the first trauma would have been when you were sent to Barbados and then your mom left you. You would have known her. You would have known the people around you because you're 18 months. I said, "What would I have done?" She goes, "You would have cried until you stopped." Dang. Mm. Fast forward now, coming back when I was 8, what did I do for a year after my aunt left me? I cried for a year. I cried myself to sleep for a year. So that alone was difficult. Then when you talk about the winter time, I'm come from a place all I know is hot all year round. Mm-hmm. Then you have to put on boots, scarf, this, that. I'm like, what am I doing? This place is not made for human consumption. Why am I even here? Why does anybody live here? Mm-hmm. When can I leave, right? Mm-hmm. And then you have that, because I came in July and then boom, you're sent into the summer, the winter, and then getting to know the kids. So the kids didn't all look like me. They didn't sound like me. They weren't doing the same things that I was doing. And that was difficult. To be called a nigger, to be called to spit in my face, tell me to go back where I came from. I'm like, what even is a nigger? Like, what does that
what
mean?
What is that word? Yes.
What is that word? Because it's not in our vocab. That's when you find out that you're Black. I'm like, what are you talking about? And since when did chocolate become a bad thing? So it was hard to even navigate the language, what they were calling me, why they were calling me, because I'd never experienced that in my life. So that was very difficult. And then going from a household where I was with my grandmother, my two uncles, two other cousins that lived in the house, to just having me and my mom in an apartment. So you go from a house, mm-hmm. you go outside in the backyard, you know, you got your vegetables, your fruits, you can pick them there. You have to go buy them. I'm like, why am I going to the grocery store to buy fruits? Where's the tree that was outside of my house? Mm-hmm. Why is it that, you know, everything has to come from a grocery store, where everything in my life back then was, my grandmother had a farm. So mm-hmm. everything was organic. Everything was there. You free. Go get it. But now you're cooped up in an apartment. You have to buy the food. And then she's gone to work half the time. So you're alone. So there was a lot of stuff to get used to.
And the perspective of running bare feet and touching the ground and having to be inside of concrete.
What is that? what is running bare feet? What is going to the beach every Sunday?
Oh, the beach. Their description of a beach is basically a lake with pebbles and rocks.
Okay, thank you. What is that? What do you mean this is a beach? We went to a Sega beach and we have to drive 2 hours. What do you mean? I don't go out my house and walk 15 minutes and boom, you're there. Mm-hmm. It was a whole lot when you come to think about it.
Now, when you describe what racism looked like in that time period as compared to what it was in the Caribbean, how is it that we were able to basically ignore what racism was at that time in the Caribbean, but still felt... From what I'm getting from your experience, was a little isolation or a lot of isolation when you moved to Canada. How can you describe the difference? Or is it that we didn't recognize what it was?
I think because also you have to think this is set in 1975, 1976, right? And for me and for other people that I met, I used to mentor and was a boss to a young man who came from Jamaica 4 years ago. And he said he didn't even know he was Black until he got here. So what I didn't experience racism like that, mm-hmm. right? Because everybody looked like me, sound like me. So when we talk about representation being matters, it matters when you look around and everybody looks like you, sounds like you, you feel at home, you feel comfortable. Nobody's saying, calling you names and discriminating against you because of the color of your skin. I didn't experience that when I go home now. But here, it is very, they say Canada is not as bad as the US. It's more subtle, but it's there and you feel it and you know it. Mm-hmm. I mean, how overt can it be when somebody just comes up to you and spits in your face? Like that, hello.
Yeah.
And then they're telling you to go back where you came from. What do you mean go back where I came from? I was born in Toronto. And as I grew older and I said, I was never going to live here all of my life. And then I became a Bajan citizen by descent mm-hmm. because my whole plan was, and it still is, to go back there and live and be free. So when you talk about the difference, there is a huge difference when a group of people are being discriminated against solely because of the color of their skin, as opposed to living in a place where everybody looks like you, sounds like you, and they are you.
Mm-hmm. In terms of representation, that's a very good point that you brought up. How can we make sure that representation is brought forward, is solid, so that children who still experience that movement between the Caribbean and countries like Canada and US still feel a part of a community?
Well, that is a very good question. And that's the thing that is now I'm transcending the book, my life purpose. I say that I'm hope in human form that heals. And I'm encouraging people to write their own stories. You should write your own stories. We should write our own story. And then kids get to see and read books that are biased for us and about us. Mm-hmm. And that is very important where you see that representation matters. And then when you're in a position, I was in IT for 30 years with computers. I was the only one that looked like me. Mm. So when you think that you can't do a job or can't go into a field because nobody looks like you is in that field, but it's in your heart and your purpose, you should go into that field. Because the kids coming behind us will know that there's somebody's paved the way and it is possible to turn the impossible to possible and lift the limits off of what we think that we can't do.
And there has been a forward movement in various cultures and various groups looking for that space to talk about representation and to talk about identifying where these notions and habits made a negative impact on cultures and societies. I can think of the recent movement in Canada where it pertained to Native Indigenous persons, you know, very down to the, I believe they call it reformative schools. Have you heard about that? What was that movement like?
That was huge, and it was heart-wrenching, and it touched so many people that when you send them to these schools and you're taking them away from their families, their culture, cutting off their hair, like it's nothing different than, you know, the slave trade, right? Mm-hmm. You're moving a people from their home and you're taking away their language and you're forcing them to conform to something different. So here it was very palatable. It was very heartbreaking to hear that they were talking about this for so long, but nobody was listening. And then to see the truth comes out, right? Mm-hmm. And I think because of that, now we're having a lot of people speaking the truth about the things, colonialism, and the things that actually happen to us as a people. And we're talking about brown people, indigenous people, Black people, people of color, mm-hmm. for lack of a different word, but they're now actually talking about that and healing, right? Mm-hmm. And that's why, again, writing books will definitely help the healing of the person, help the healing of the community.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about that healing and themes of resilience and what forgiveness looks like. All right. So TNT, going to...
The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.
Welcome back, TNT. If you're just joining me at 9:31, inside the human impact, we have online Miss Fatima Gould, who is a Barbadian author who wrote the acclaimed memoir Over the Wall, a profoundly personal account of a spiritual transformation from despair to hope, drawing from her Caribbean heritage and profound experiences of overcoming adversity through faith. She inspires countless readers worldwide with her vivid storytelling and powerful message of resilience, and help others to embrace healing and break generational patterns. And that's something that we didn't touch on before. So before we get to the difficult task of healing and actually getting to the point of forgiveness, the idea of generational and cultural influence, what does that look like, and what does it represent for cultures, West Indian culture? How do we keep the traditions but leave behind the generational trauma that may not come from some experiences?
And I think we can do that by first acknowledging it, talking about it. We can also write, journaling, meditation. And I really think that talking about it really helps, and writing it, like I was saying, putting it in a book. And also, because to put it in my traumas and my generational patterns of behavior in a book was also healing. It took 2 years, because every time I had to relive something, I had to stop, I had to get coaching, and then I could continue on. So I think if we really looked at that mental health and how are the things that we can do to help that, that's a way that we can look at the generational trauma and the behaviors. And keeping the culture is in books and movies, stories, your radio program, like that impact, like keep talking about it, bring it to the forefront instead of keep sweeping it under the rug. Because I know I'm not the only one. In Jamaica, they call them barrel babies. I'm not the only one who's been through this. I mean, from when Trudeau, the father, opened up the borders in 1960, that's when we came to Canada, right? So what's happened since then? And now we're seeing that you came here with the promise of a good job, pension, and benefits. But what did you really get after that? You just got the trauma, the generational patterns. And one I can really think of, when my grandmother had kids, she sent them to live with her mother. The more that they have, you went to live with your grandparents, and then more came after my mom. So you're already in a pattern of, it's okay to send your kids to live with your parent, but your parent is now miles and miles away in a different country, not a 20-minute walk. So maybe what they were thinking, it would be the same, but it's not the same. So we have to keep talking about it. We have to write about it. We have to meditate on it. We have to get clarity. We have to ask for forgiveness for ourselves first, and then forgive the other person. And that forgiveness is for you. And maybe that will also release something in that other person.
And a lot of iconic persons with Caribbean and migrant heritage have started talking about being in, as you said, movies, television shows that express and show the experience of those who've made the journey, with the both positive and negative attributes, because there is a question of, or at least a discussion on, acknowledging West Indian contribution to the diaspora, also the development of these countries. We could think of Kwame Ture. We could think of a lot of others. I can think of like Atto Bolden from Trinidad and Tobago in terms of sport. From Jamaica, we have Usain Bolt. I'm trying to think of a Bayesian. Alison Hines in terms of culture. You know, all of these people who come together from those experiences to create a culture that is in these quote-unquote first world environments that has contributed to their overall culture as well. So I think beginning to acknowledge those contributions would help as well.
Yeah, and we have somebody here. Her name is Jean Augustine, and she was a member of parliament, and she was hailed for bringing Black History Month to here, to Canada, mm-hmm. And her team. So, yeah, we celebrate her, but with this, she's really known, and these things come out during Black History Month. Mm-hmm. But what about all the other 365 days of the year? You're right. How can we celebrate and bring these people and people from the past, people from the present, so that our kids can see that and they can become the future representation?
Mm-hmm. Also to acknowledge, and I just recall this, the reverse happens a lot as well, where if it is that you are in America or Canada and you have children who seem to, quote unquote, give trouble, you send them to the Caribbean for Caribbean discipline. You know, how does that affect thinking of individuals who were born in places like Canada and America and have to go through that as well? Is it the same sort of experience for them? Or is it that they feel a release when they come to the Caribbean?
Listen, I don't know what you're talking about, right? Because when my mother was ready to give a lashing and a katas, you got a lashing and a katas. There is no, I'm going to spare you a katas because you're here in Canada. No, you're still going to get it. Mm-hmm. I don't know what that is. And the same thing with my children. If I had to give them a spanking or yelling or talking to, then they're going to get it. I'm not sending them anywhere to do that. So the people around me, we don't know what that is. We don't know what that is because your parents are still Caribbean to the core, and they didn't forget mm-hmm. about licks. That didn't leave their vocabulary. I wish it did. Mm-hmm. That should have left one of the things that left their vocabulary when they landed. That should be the one, but that did not leave. So I don't know what that is.
No, well, what I mean is, like, you know, the kids who, the parents who are living in Canada or United States saying that this child needs some Caribbean discipline because I can't handle them in this environment where there's so many restrictions, and I can't give the cut tail like you just mentioned because either CPS is going to be called on me, 911, you know. So let them experience the grandparents in the West Indies.
You know what we got? You know what I got when I said, you know, that there's a thing where we can call CAS or you call them. I will pack your bag and put you and the bag outside and wait for them to come.
So, yeah.
The thing is, that scares the living daylights of you. Where are they taking me? Who are they going to come? Mm-hmm. It's true. That's just, for some children, I find that that's a manipulative tactic that they use. But if you, as the parent, still hold firm about what you know and what you can and what the thing that you want to instill in your child, mm-hmm. then that's what needs to be done instead of being afraid of a system. And then there's also ways of getting around that system. I was told as an adult later how you can discipline your child and just sitting down and having a conversation with them. Well, if you don't like the rules and they call you, they're going to take you away and we'll never see you again. And that's a whole nother thing. Mm-hmm. And I know that parents are doing that, but they have to think about what trauma are you now putting this child into that they're going to go into their home. They could be molested. They can be physically, mentally abused. The trauma would be worse than actually sitting down and having a conversation about the discipline and why they need to be disciplined and the consequences of not having any discipline.
And that brings us to the beginning of understanding the story, understanding what has happened, to get to the part of forgiveness and understanding where transformation comes in. Not only personal, but transformation for the relatives involved, community involved, because it does extend to community eventually. Because how you deal with what happens in the house extends outside as well. So what guidance did you write in your book to create the safe space for that to happen?
So the safe space came in really being authentic about what it is that I was writing. The first draft was very fluffy. And then I was told, what is this? This doesn't have anything that's transformative, like what you're speaking about. So then I had to go back and be honest with myself about the things that did happen to me. Be honest about the things that, you know, what was the effects of a lot of introspection, a lot of looking at my life and saying, okay, I need to forgive this person. I need to forgive that young man who came up to me and spat in my face because he didn't know what he was doing. He's taking on a persona and an attitude about me, not knowing about me, that was passed on probably from his family members. Mm-hmm. So then you have to start to look at your life and forgive that. Forgive the fact that, okay, my mom brought me here, but she did the best that she could do with what she had at the time as being a single parent. And what does that let? Forgive that. And it's a lot of soul searching, a lot of reflection, a lot of calling on God, the universe, to forgive internally, to be able to forgive external. And I think the book creates that safe space by giving the examples of what it is, and then how do you manage that and lay the foundation for the forgiveness.
Do you think that programs should be done in communities to encourage the appreciation of different cultures and ways of doing things so that you become aware of differences so that those aren't used against? How would that look in Canada, for say?
I would say definitely having programs where you now, so if I had a program where I could invite Indigenous elders to come, right? Talk about their prayers, talk about their smudging, talk about how they use their fruits, their vegetables, living off the land to fuel your body instead of being fueled by pills to heal most of the things. Then we would realize that we're more the same than we are different, right? And when we get to embrace African spirituality or spirituality of Indigenous people, we would realize that we are so about the land and about each other because we're all in the same ecosystem, then we are different. And I think that programs like that would definitely help, definitely bring in South Asian, Asian, once we begin to understand our own, bring in other, and then we will see that we're more alike than we are different. And then that there's just a few people want to divide and conquer. And then you'll get to the healing part of yourself, healing of community, and healing of the world that way. Because I also have a program that's called Inclusive by Design. And it asks, are you inclusive? Are you diverse? And what are the things that you were excluded from as a child? Mm-hmm. And then when you start to unpack all of that, you get to realize, hey, we're not very different at all.
Just this week, we started introducing to the curriculum in schools, steel pan, which has been recognized as our national instrument. And there was a whole debate on its place and if it, what it invokes in terms of carnival and then the time and place. Should things like that be included in curriculums about different cultures to also bring about that awareness? What do you think about that?
I would say yes, because I saw a documentary on why the steel pan came about, right? And if you know that, okay, so we're drumming, and the drumming, they said that it riled up the slaves and it got them all excited because they're sending coded messages, or they cut off their hands. So what did they do? They went from that drum to creating the steel pan. So to know that history, to teach our kids our history is very, very, very important. Once they know why it came about, the history of it, how does it really fit in the past, the present, and the future, then that child would gain a confidence about themselves that says, hey, this is my roots, this is my culture, this is who I am, and they stand tall and confident about that. But if you're not, again, writing books about us, for us, about us, mm-hmm. and giving it to future generations, then they get to know the truth and they would know why steel pan is important, just not only to Trinidad, but the rest of the Caribbean, right?
By extension, the world, yeah.
And in the world, why is it so important? Why is drumming, period, so in it's an indigenous culture here in for the Native Indians? Mm-hmm. It's everywhere. Having a drum is everywhere. They do the hand one. They do the talking drum. It's in Africa. It's all over the world. So why shouldn't it be taught in schools, not just the steel pan, but all drumming mm-hmm. and the history of drumming and what does it do? And it shifts when you're listening to it, it shifts your vibration and it makes you happy. I've never listened to a calypso and be sad. Like, what is that? Because you're listening to the percussions, the music, and you get happy, right? Mm-hmm.
And like you said, it's all about learning, as I say, the origins of it, what it was used for, and acknowledging what it does to the spirit when you hear it in the present time. I want to thank you so much for this conversation. It's been enlightening. And do you have like any tips that you can give to persons in their healing journey to come to that point of forgiveness?
I would say tip number one is spend time alone. Spend time alone with your thoughts, spend time journaling, spend time in meditation, spend time reflecting, and then cry if you have to cry. Do not shove your emotions down. Let them flow through you like the sunlight, like the wind. Spend time in nature. Go to the beach. Take a walk outside in trees and breathe. Mm-hmm. Just feel the tension leaving your body by just breathing. And the second thing is, be careful who you are letting, the energies from people you are letting into your life. When they're draining you, when they're negative, let them go. Let them go. People leave because they need to leave. And then new people who are vibrating on the same level as you will come in, and then you'll see opportunities. You'll feel lighter. You'll feel like a world of lifted off of your shoulders. Those are my tips.
Thank you, Fatima. And when next you're finished with your next book, you know where to find us so we can have another chat. Take care.
The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.